Greetings, Earthlings. Welcome to Satellite, Profile Theater's online supplementary magazine. Satellite is where you will come for interviews with artists, activists, and educators, and whoever else might give you a deeper understanding of the work that Profile puts on the stage. With Satellite, Profile is always looking for new avenues to deepen our audience's experience of the art, pulling back the curtain, providing insight, and giving our audience a glimpse of the act of creation. And now, welcome to Satellite.
Hello all, and welcome to part two in our Satellite series orbiting our playwright convening. I'm Tamara Carroll, Profile's Director of Community Engagement. Two of our featured season playwrights, Christopher Diaz and Christopher Oscar Pena, recently joined us here in Portland for a week-long residency. Diaz was here workshopping his play Reggie Hoops, and Pena a piece called Our Orange Sky, which Profile commissioned. We are beyond thrilled to be presenting the world premiere productions of both plays as part of our 23-24 season. In our last episode, we spoke to Profile's artistic director, Josh Hecht, about the significance of the convening itself, both as a midpoint of our multi-year American Generation season and the importance of the playwright residency in Profile's mission to engage deeply with not just a playwright's work, but with the playwrights themselves. So throughout the week, the Christophers not only worked with local artists, actors, designers in the rehearsal room, but they also spent a lot of time talking to a wide variety of Profile's constituencies. And I know for me, it really deepened my understanding of the circumstances that have shaped their voices and the intersection of perspectives that they're incorporating into their work. In this episode of Satellite, we hear both of the playwrights and the two workshop directors, Leah C. Gardner and Damaso Rodriguez, reflecting on the week's work, just how it went, what was learned, and what next steps might be. In the first half, I sat down with Christopher Diaz and Christopher Oscar Pena together, and we talked about a very wide variety of things. Here we're talking about the different influences on how we learn to express love and affection for the people in our lives, whether that's culture, gender, our individual families. And we go from there. I hope you enjoy listening as much as I really enjoyed talking to these two.
Well, I mean, listen, we're Latinos, and like, when I became an adult, I'm like, Latino love is literally taking the thing that you are most insecure about and naming you that. Yeah. You know, it's like people are like, hey, gordo, and you're like, I don't call, what? You know, or like, yeah, it's flaco, or like, whatever it is that you hate about yourself, that's the thing they're going to call you. And I'm like, are you sure you love me? Because this is not how I, this, but it's the way you pick on each other.
It's one of those things, you know, at the risk of going down this road, that where the scales are, where it turn, you know, that term toxic is always like, where does toxic turn really toxic? Or, you know, where is it like a playful thing? Where is it? And those things I think are investigatable, right? I think there are times where it's, you know, we call people, you know, I call my friends whatever, and it's out of entirely understood and respected love. And even that can be a problem. It's the gordo thing. Yeah. Can be, you know, can be for real. And it, even, maybe this was fine at a certain point between us, and now it's not fine. I think that stuff is it's really hard, and it's really interesting, you know. But you build so many relationships, I think, can be built around that. With good things can come out of a playful, you know, disrespect.
Yeah.
But what does that mean, you know? Right. But and this is not specific to any gender or sexuality thing, but I think in a family that's together consistently, we saw this a lot during the pandemic, it's hard and exhausting to consistently do the things that I do in a university setting, or in a, you know, in our setting here, where we have that incredible list of like commitments and those things. I think it's great to have those things. It's a lot easier to live by those all the time for the 6 hours of rehearsal than it is for those times when you're getting tired and you're getting, you know, frustrated in different kinds of ways. It's awesome to have the ideals. I think the ideals are really fantastic. And I think that sometimes we slip in those situations. And to have real world reality based tactics for what we do in those situations is important. So that if it is that I start picking up this shorthand with somebody, that the shorthand doesn't then fester.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Into what it seems like, you know, it's happening in your family.
Mm-hmm.
But that your family, no, the world of your, the family of your play.
No, but I do. I also think like we're having a very specific conversation in a very specific time, and like we're living in a constantly evolving moment where people are sort of like looking back at behaviors and cultural societal behaviors, and it's interesting because we're so educated and aware that we sort of unpack everything. But then there's like, you know, the generation before us that's like, oh, I love you. I just called you. Like, it was a cute nickname, and that you are now feeling means all these other things that they don't, right? And we're like, no, well, actually, when you said that to me, it hurt my feelings. But I think it's funny to now name those things. And how do you name and unpack like hundreds of years of passed down things, right? And just because something existed for a long time doesn't mean it should continue to exist, as you just said. But it's also like I also wonder how much we are. Oh, this is going to be complicated to say. How much we are making things worse than maybe they are.
If that's the right. It's. I think. Is it in this draft of your play? Previous drafts of your play. I think it's in. I think in all of them, where I believe Mondo, the dad, says something like, "You're so sad because you're so bored."
Yes, mm-hmm. yes.
And I think that's one of those great provocative things that is like not true and also not false.
Yes,
right.
Yeah.
And there is something about generations. My grandfather, my kid's great grandfather, he's 93 years old. He's alive. He's alive and he's strong and he's functioning. And if it was up to him, he would still be working.
Yeah.
At 93 years old. Because his life has been built so much around service and providing and living. He's involved in a church now because I think it's like drives the church van around, like 93 years old. Because he's got that sense of like staying busy and pushing and pushing and pushing. Versus there is a sense of space and there's a sense of time, even though we're all busy and working more than ever. You know what I mean? Like there is something about we have time to be in our, you know, be a little drakey, right? In our feelings. But I think there's good and bad for that.
It is. I mean, like, I don't think of myself as like a depressed or sad person, but there are days that I'm sad, right? And like, it is very easy for me to stay in bed and just be there. And what happens is I think about why I'm sad over and over and over, right? And then there are days when I'm like, I force myself, like I'll literally set things up so I can't do that. Mm-hmm. And the minute that I get out of my bed and I'm at the coffee shop and I see people, like I'm energized and happy, right? So it is like a literal doing things does help. I mean, not always, obviously, but I want everyone to think I'm really smart, but I'm gonna reveal my source. That thing about you're sad because you're bored is a thing that a great writer director that I'm sure you know, this Filipino director Ralph Pena, who everyone thinks is my uncle, and I call him Uncle Ralph, and we both tell people that he's my uncle, but he's not. He and I went and saw a play once, and we were both really bored. I'm not going to say what it was. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, he was like, I can't keep watching plays like that. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, your generation is so bored and so sad. Mm-hmm. And he said, I grew up in the Philippines and Imelda Marcos killed my friends.
Yeah.
Right? Which is in the play, which is literally in the play. So I'm giving credit to Ralph. And he said, Imelda Marcos killed my friends. He's like, that's what I dealt with, and that's what made me sad.
Yeah.
He's like, you guys sit around here and you're sad because, you know, you're like bored. And it really, you know, so I think it's right. Like the world is a crazy place and we're all thinking about it. But also like there are things that have been worse and people have survived and worked and strived and succeeded. Yeah. And it's very easy, I think, to get in your head and focus on all the negative and let you become sad.
I think part of it, or what comes to mind, is like what your expectations are, right? Like what your expectations have been said to be. A high school teacher of mine once said, and I don't know if this is true, but like when they ask people who have had arranged marriages about their level of satisfaction with their marriage versus people who married for love, like it was about the same. Like, because your expectation of what that relationship is going to be is just different. And so, yeah, so I see expectations, both like what the characters expect for themselves and what is expected of them, as playing a huge role in both of your work. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about expectations.
I will also say this is true of both our plays. Our plays have parents who had to really fight against the culture, you know, class. They, you know, so they I think they really were parents in both plays who made everything possible for their kids, right? And so maybe that means that like you're crippled by the knowledge that you can have whatever you want, or you should be able to have whatever you want, and then if you don't succeed, what does that say about you, right? So it's easy to then fall apart. But I think those people who were like, we worked twice as hard, again, if it's boredom, they didn't have time to be bored, right? Because they were just trying to pay the bills, they were just trying to succeed. But us who have more do have time to be bored, or do have time to think about our needs and wants. And so I think then it becomes very easy to get lost in that and to expect more and to want more. Yeah. And just because we want more and can have more doesn't mean we are also working for more, you know?
Yeah, for sure. Generationally, my generation, I think we're the same generation, but at like different, you know, different edges of it. But we're the generation that comes out of the civil rights generation. And we're a generation that comes out of this real striver sense of like, work twice as hard to get half as far, be understanding that is like, that's accepted, that language. I feel like this generation is like, why would I get half as far?
Yeah,
you know, like I should get at least as far, and that's fair, that's valid, that's real. And especially with this different understanding of the conditions, the world is changed, and there is, you shouldn't have to be in that spot. We're also generation, and this is one of those things, when I start to go down this road, I'm not allowed to invoke this name anymore, but I'm going to invoke this name because I have to. My generation was foundationally shaped by The Cosby Show.
Uh-huh.
And The Cosby Show was a show where two people of color, there was a doctor and a lawyer, and they raised their kids, and they were a functional family together, and that was like an expectation of success. And then the better one to reference is A Different World, where then they were in a college together, and it was the most different kinds of black people that I've ever seen on a television show. And that expectation that you could be all these things. But the difference between growing up with that and growing up with the generation that made that show, that the generation who makes that show is like, oh, this is the dream that we're sort of coming into. The generation who watches that show is like, oh, this is what my life should be like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's who my friends are. My friends are all the friends who watch that of all different races. My group of friends is like, we're all different races and everything. And my wife always says, you should make friends, but it should be minority friends, because that's our group of, like, I mean, yes. Let me be clear. The television show you should make is the show Friends, but it should be called Minority Friends, because all of our friends are different minorities, and we share this sense of, like, that's the way that the world is right now. So then when it's not that, right, when we're on a season, we can talk about things and say, like, oh, I'm on this theater season and I'm the only person of color on the season. That shouldn't be that way. Or Chris and I are the only two, let's say there's five shows and Chris and I are both in the same season, which has never happened before. Then we can be in that position to be like, no, wait, there should be more.
Yeah.
You can go further. And that expectation, that should be the expectation. And also we should be able to recognize that, like, it's a lot of progress.
Yeah. Yes. It's funny. I always laugh. I was pitching a show once. I'm not going to say to where. And the lead was a Latina woman. I was pitching with Gina Rodriguez. It was for Gina to star in. Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to tell you what it was. It was I got the rights to Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, mm-hmm. on one of our films. This is like my dream project.
Oh, wow.
And we pitched it to everybody. And at one point, you know, that movie, if you don't know the movie, it's about a woman who like is trying to kill her husband or her lover. And so I pitched a show, and literally the white executive was like, I feel like we've done this show. Like, how is this different than... Mm-hmm. And I just, like, looked at her, mm-hmm. and I was like, I was like, I don't understand why you think that white people are, like, unique. I was like, how is Anna Kendrick's show, Love Life, any different than Sex and the City or Girls? And I'm like, on the page, those are shows about lost 20-something women and their girlfriends in New York City who want to be writers looking for love. And she just, like, looked at me baffled. And I'm like, my show, even if it was about that, is fundamentally different because I am a Latino person. Gina is a Latina woman. And our experiences in the world are vastly different than yours. And so putting our voices out there is different. And it was just interesting to me that that they, as white people, think that they are unique and different and that we are all the same. You know, it's shocking to me. You know, and like our plays, like, we're talking about big themes because we're at a point in our lives where we're sharing a lot of the things that our parents did for us, right? And what meant for us. But stylistically, tonally, our play's going to be any more different. And it's always a shame to me that, like, 2, 3, 4 white people can exist on a season and ADs believe that they're unique and radically different and that they don't understand that we should be in conversation with each other and, like, Fernanda Coppola, right?
Yeah.
And that we're all going to be really, really different in how we say these things.
I think it's out there. I think it's how do you articulate, because I think those questions are all valid questions. And the question of, like, what is my angle into this show and what's the approach? There just needs to be language for all of these things. And you need to be, you know, like, the problem with for me, the problem with notes, which, you know, in film and TV, it's notes. Here it's, you know, it can be feedback, but it can also be toxic or problematic in certain ways, can be the lack of care and the lack of imagination with things like that, right? And it's like, well, what are we actually doing in this play? And what are your traditions in which you speak in? And, you know, thinking fundamentally, the difference of the piece, you know, piece you're talking about is based in Almodovar. Like, it's based in, like, you know, those are that, not just because that is a different language, but because that's a different artistic take.
Yes.
And right, hip-hop plays. Yes. Plays that are influenced by hip-hop. And that doesn't mean that they have to be about hip-hop. Reggie Hoops is a hip-hop play. It has nothing to do with hip-hop music. It has nothing to do with hip-hop culture. But the way that the people talk, the way that I think, the way that I move from scene to scene, and I move, you know, we both have moments where we move from one thing into another thing. It's one scene, and then characters fly up into the sky to deliver a monologue, or we meld back into a flashback, and we shoot ahead into another situation. Those are cultural techniques to recognize that all of these cultural markers, and not just specifically cultural highfalutin cultural markers, but anything that you bring to the table is your artistic value and is what you do differently. And that's only helped by the diversity. I'm sitting up. I'll get in trouble down this road. I get really concerned and frustrated with a lot of DEI, IDEA pitches and procedures because they feel checkmarky and they don't feel foundational approach sometimes. And I would rather work in a place where those things exist than a place where they do not. But I don't want it to be about, well, we need to check the box of having this kind of person in the season. It's like, well, why do you want to have this kind of person this season? Because they bring a fundamentally different perspective, and maybe they bring a bunch of fundamentally different, maybe a fundamentally different audience, maybe a different way to do it, and that requires a lot of stuff. I'm going to say one more thing on this, and I'm going to shut up. The two best shows that I saw on Broadway last season were Ain't No Mo and K-Pop, and K-Pop was one of the greatest nights of theater that I've ever had in my life. Both of those shows I saw the week that they were closing, and the audiences were activated in a way that they weren't normally activated. Both of those shows also were so formally different and audacious, and I'm not cursing left and right, and I want to say bad words for emphasis, but I'm not going to. But they were so formally audacious, and they needed different ways to be supported to allow people to understand how formally audacious they were doing and what they were in their construction. And I get really concerned about situations where people may be like, great K-pop, great, we should do K-pop. K-pop is this other thing. There's an audience here attached to it, so we're just going to do it, and we're going to support it in the traditional way that we've supported everything else. When that show, is a billion K-pop fans should have been your audience.
Yeah, they're out there. You just didn't know how to get to them. And I just have to say, like, you're like, shouting out K-pop, Jason Kim, love that guy, great writer. But part of the reason I think that show was what it was is because it was an interesting new world, new to us, new to me, right? Like, I don't, that like so many people love, but like they took a world that's beloved and they put it on stage and said, this is theater. And I actually think that's what you do. I mean, I was thinking about like the plays of yours that I'm really familiar with, and it's like, Chad Didi is, it's a boxing ring on stage. It's literally a play about wrestling, right?
Yep.
You know, Arroyos, you put DJs on stage. Yep. You know, Reggie Hoops, you're like, we're going to use basketball language. And I feel like those are cultural events. There are things that people love, and there are things that we don't have in the theater. And I think elevating your voice gets those people in the theater, right? They're going to be like, what? I don't know you can do wrestling in a fucking Broadway house. They should, right? And then if you give them, Arroyos, you give them the next, and you let them know that the things that they value are important to us as well, then they're going to learn to love the theater and respect the theater and think, oh, this is a place that I should be visiting, right? And
yeah,
it gives the rest of us more access. But I think that until like the people who have not been invited in are allowed to create the world, those audiences aren't going to come. Like, I when I was a kid, people would say, like, why don't people love the theater? And I'm like, why would 16-year-old gay Latino Chris Pena want to go see Long Day's Journey? Like, why do I care about a four-hour, like, play about white drunk people screaming at each other?
I'm going to move us on a little bit.
I know, you keep trying to talk about the plays, too, and I'm just like, let's talk about
yeah. Well, I have two. Okay, so how are you feeling about, I guess the way the reading landed, the way the readings landed, thinking about how audiences in Portland specifically are connecting to two plays that are like very New York. Any thoughts about Portland as...
Portland as a place.
Portland as a place.
Well, I mean, I think the profile has been really, really great. Everybody at Profile has been super amazing. And our audiences have been really great. They were I would say, a typical theater audience, slightly older and white. And I feel like they were really engaged with both our plays. And Chris alluded to this. In my play, there's a moment where there's a 5-minute monologue that's in Spanish. And we keep grappling with whether it should be translated or not, or should the audience be told what the monologue is. And what I learned last night is that people really leaned in. And I was shocked at the amount of white older audiences that seemed engaged in spite of not knowing what they were being told. But what I'm learning so far is that in the little time I've been here, the audience seems game. And so it's an exciting thing to push forward and to not feel like, do I have to do something different or dump something down or change myself for these people?
Yeah. I think it's an affirmation that new play audiences are less afraid than sometimes new play theaters think that their audiences are, of inventive, groundbreaking stuff. Sometimes it can be really... Also, your play, please take this in the spirit that's given, it's not trying to break crazy ground.
Right.
You're trying to let a character speak her language on stage. Like, so, you know, it's, you know, so it's not, you're not, it's not transgressive in a crazy, it's transgressive in an important way. And the audience, I think, 100% came with you on that, and as they should. I think, you know, it's hard to say about Portland. I was walking around a little bit today, and I was like, oh yeah, I haven't seen anything, because we've been busy. And when we landed, Leah, my director, and I, we were talking, and we were sort of like, passing judgment, but like, oh my God, Portland is this and Portland is that. And then we were like, oh wait, we've seen two neighborhoods and two very specific neighborhoods.
Yeah.
You know, and so I haven't explored that. What I will say is that Josh and Josh's team, and present company included, have been really, really wonderful with us, taking care of us, making sure that we've got the things that we needed. Our casts have been remarkable. You know, always a challenge when you come to a new theater town and you haven't directly cast your play, haven't gone through the audition process, not just of knowing, are you going to have the right people to play the role, you know, sort of demographically, what those skills are going to be. And, you know, the new play development thing is a weird, funky kind of sets of skills that not everybody gets to develop all the time, particularly in a town like Portland in New York. If you're an actor in New York City, you're constantly doing readings of new work and getting new pages and turning things out. And I had no sense of what that was going to be. And I think that these actors really showed those skills, even if, you know, some of them do it all the time, some of them don't. And that's just as important as all of the, you know, we talk a lot about the what I'm calling the demographic stuff, which is important, but the work is the work. And if people can do the work, that's great.
All right. So I asked you both, when you were on your way here, before you got here, sort of where your plays were and what you saw the work of the week being. Where are they walking away, and what is the work ahead?
I mean, I think we're both ready for $1 million productions. Mm-hmm. You know, just gives us flying sets. you know, I think Chris said this a little bit somewhere else, that some, like, you think you know what you're going to do a lot of times, and then you show up and you're like, oh, wait, there's 17 other things I didn't realize I needed to do. I feel really excited because I feel like, and sometimes you rewrite and you rewrite in the wrong direction and you're like, I just made my play worse. I think that I'm getting really, really close, and I think it feels like it's about sharpening. When I first wrote this play in November, it was like 70 pages. It was the shortest play I've ever written. It was 65 minutes. I was so proud of myself. I was like, look at me, not overwriting. And then Josh was like, I think that maybe you need 4 more things in this play. Mm-hmm. And then we turned it into a 2-act play. And on since last weekend when we read the play with 2 acts, we were like, oh, this play is actually, it's too short to be 2 acts. And really where the act break is right now, nothing's really happened in a big way yet. And then, you know, I rewrote over the week, and then we did the reading yesterday with no act break, and we were like, oh, the play is 40 minutes longer now, so maybe we do need that act break. So it's stuff like that where I think I filled out the work, and so now it's just about refining, but I do feel like I'm really close. And actually, again, like this monologue thing, one of the things that we both know is that a lot of times you don't know what your play is all the way until you have an audience. Mm-hmm. And so I think a lot of that work is that refining is going to be about, you know, previews with an audience. So it's really exciting that we both know that we have production set to keep the plays going.
Yeah. I'm really glad that you found an actor who was able to do that monologue in Spanish.
That's so great.
Yeah, that was, I mean, it was felt like such an important thing to be able to see. And I'm really, yeah.
And she really reminded me of my mother. Tiny, tiny brown woman with a thick accent who's so cute and warm and lovely. And it was like, oh, you're there. So it was great.
Yeah. The play is the same play, same scenes happen in the same structure, same order. We'll continue to do so. I cut 7 pages out of it. Rewrote, I would say, a rewrite on at least 90% of the pages within it. And of those rewrites, I would say found one scene that is brand new, not brand new, but the way we approach it is brand new and clicks into place in a way that reveals a bunch of other stuff. I would say 25 of the pages that I wrote are not what the end of it is going to be. And so lots of progress. You know, if you looked at it from the outside, it may look like exactly the same kind of play in a lot of ways, but the things that we've changed, the things that we found are really important. And just to echo something that Chris said, the fact that I get to work on this knowing, and they're still here, but knowing that, and I think for both of us, knowing that we've got a team, we've got a director that we trust, we have some sense of what it might look and feel like in bodies of actors who may or may not be, stay with us, but you know, whatever those capacities might be. But to know that this is a step on a journey that has a finish line and that is supported all the way through by the same company, in Chris's case, germinated here and will continue to go all the way through. It's a rare opportunity. It's an important opportunity. More theaters should do it. And more theaters should have us come because we're really good together.
Yeah. We only work together now in Paris.
We're the Chrises. Yeah. We're the next everything everywhere all at once.
Amazing. Well, I definitely, the past few nights have like had trouble falling asleep because I was thinking about these plays. And then, like, you know, get in the shower in the morning, I'm still thinking about them. And so it's been a real privilege to be in the room for like a little bit of the process and see them evolve. And I'm really excited to be able to keep doing that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. And just, sorry, one last button on this, which is that you are awesome. And you are rare in a lot of these places. Yes. And the stuff that you do. And just to mention to the folks who are listening to this, you guys have something special here in Profile.
Yeah.
And what Josh and Tamara and this whole team are doing. I hope you can, you know, continue to support them. Not the least of which is because you got to come and see at least 2 more plays by the two of us over the next year.
Yeah.
It's true. All right. Thanks,
guys.
Thank
you. Top that, y'all.
That was 2 very exhausted, but I think also very creatively stimulated playwrights named Christopher Oscar Peña and Christopher Diaz, who I think really found a lot of ways in which their work was exploring a lot of the same ideas and in conversation with each other, which I think is part of the genius of having them both here in residence at the same time. After the break, I talked to directors Leah C. Gardner and Damaso Rodriguez about their experiences supporting the plays and the playwrights in this specific moment of their evolution.
Coming up next for Profile Theater, a coming-of-age story from one of the writers of Jane the Virgin, Insecure, and Sweet Bitter. How to Make an American Son by Christopher Oscar Peña. Honduran-born Mando built a successful janitorial business so he could pay for his son Orlando's privileged life, which Orlando enjoys while being embarrassed by his father's old-fashioned ideals and line of work. Father and son each face their own crises at the same time as they try to realize their version of the American dream, as they learn who they are and where they fit in a society that won't let them truly belong. Catch How to Make an American Son June 8th through 25th at Imago Theater. Tickets available online now at profiletheater.org.
Welcome back to Satellite Beyond the Page. In this half, I sit down with Leah C. Gardner, who directed the workshop reading of Christopher Diaz's play Reggie Hoops, and Damaso Rodriguez, who directed the workshop reading of the play Our Orange Sky by Christopher Oscar Peña. Gardner is an Obie-winning director who directs for the stage, television, and film. She's worked all over the world, but these days primarily focuses on opportunities in New York and London, so we feel extra lucky to have been able to coax her out to Portland to bring all of her expertise on this workshop. Many Portlanders will be familiar with Damaso Rodriguez from his 9 years as artistic director at Artist Repertory Theater, but Rodriguez's work has been seen at numerous theaters across the country, including Seattle Rep, South Coast Rep, Actors Theater of Louisville, and Oregon Shakespeare Festival, just to scratch the surface. Both of these directors are comfortable with classical texts, have worked on musicals, and are also conversant in new work development and share a passion for supporting playwrights in new work. As a director myself, and particularly as a director who is really excited about new work, I appreciated their ability to share some really concrete methods and approaches to staging these readings. All right, so here we are, Sunday, getting ready to wrap up. Actually, I guess both of you were pretty much have done your parts, yeah?
We're done.
You're coasting.
Yeah.
We just get to go to the reception, I think.
Nice. So, one word to describe the week, if you had to describe the week in one word.
Brilliant.
Exciting.
Okay, and now you can describe it using many words. Yeah, just how did the week go?
I thought it was an absolutely well-orchestrated, without a hitch, exciting, as you say, thrilling week of exploration, discovery, play, and fun. And you rarely get that at theater companies because most of the time it's not as well organized and it's not as well planned out. And the staff isn't always on board with where the artistic director's vision rests. And it felt like Profile did something really right with this, and I felt very protected and safe and looked after. And it was really, and I thought that the timing of everything, like sort of the 20 hours of rehearsal that we had, was really spread out in a nice way, so that we, you know, you guys even, it seemed to me, took jet lag into consideration. So it was really fun. And just if, in my case, working with Diaz, you know, Christopher Diaz, he's like a lollipop. He's like a dream. And it was a lot of fun for me.
I had a really, I would describe it very much the same way. And I'll just add that I felt like everyone in both casts, because we got to interact with, it was nice to be a part of a bigger team, even though you had your own project. You kind of sensed how we were overlapping between the two Chris's plays, and we were bumping into each other at the beginning, in the middle, and the end of the process, and seeing each other's work. But I felt like the casts also knew what our purpose was. I think because we spent time as two creative teams at the beginning of the process, led by Josh, kind of framing it, inviting the playwrights to say what their goals were this week, and then the directors could be on board with that and introduce the cast to the idea. And I felt all along we knew we were here to support these plays in this moment, all of us kind of service to this like snapshot this week, knowing that there was a production in the future, but that wasn't our focus. Our focus was asking questions about the text and kind of meeting the writers where they are at this moment. And it's really, really, I feel like the actors all knew that was their part too, and led to like a really great energy in the process. I agree. I remember in the first day where it was just the playwrights, the Profile artistic staff, and us, and we just grabbed parts and read first from Chris Diaz's play. And I remember we read a scene together.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting as directors to kind of meet that way.
Right.
We didn't barely know each other 30 minutes at that point. And we were just scene partners.
Right.
So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, I'd never been in a closed reading like that where it's just the artistic team. Is that very common?
Yeah, I've done that a lot. But somehow it felt special this time. I don't know. I guess it feels special all the time, because you're with your colleagues who, like your designers who usually don't read, but you know more than likely acted in high school and college. So it's always really good fun to have the opportunity to play with your colleagues in a different way than you're used to.
Yeah.
Can you talk about a little bit about the conversations? Did you get to talk to the designers, or was it just the playwrights that got to talk to the designers?
Yeah, well, you know, Leah and I actually were just talking about how great designers, our favorite designers, are also great dramaturgs, right? And so to have a design dramaturgy perspective in the process, I think is really a wonderful hallmark of this convening. So we each met, first of all, the designers were at the table when we read through the plays together in that pre-weekend, right before we had the actors join the process. But then we had separate meetings, because we had a sound designer, Matt Weens, right? And then Dan Meeker, a set designer. And I remember we had separate little breakout groups with the playwright director and each designer. And then we traded sound world with scenic world. And it was just, you know, really led by the designer in our conversation was what question they asked the playwright questions to kind of frame some things up, and it was good. In the case of Our Orange Sky, there are a lot of questions about design within the stage directions, right? The way the stage directions are written on that piece, it's very open and poetic and ambitious and cinematic, and so. I think there are a lot of ways the play could be staged. We talked in our conversations about, okay, is it the $1 million budget version? Let's talk about that. And we spent a little bit of time talking about that. And then we spent time we were in the theater and we were just looking at the stage here at Imago, where the play presumably will be performed. And we started imagining, okay, we don't have $1 million now. What's that like? And I think that informed the draft that Chris went back to work on the Wednesday of the week.
Yeah, I mean, we had the exact similar experience. We just, Chris Diaz did most of the talking and the dreaming, and then I sort of piped in periodically about just sort of the dramaturgy of direction and how, if we're going to dream big, how his play can move in space, and whether or not it's a sort of, are we treating it as a very naturalistic production? And if so, would there be a second floor, as you get in so many family dramas? So It was really, really great because Dan and Matt kind of came in with thoughts about the play and thoughts about how they would approach it. But what's so great about that moment, sort of the connective tissue of designers bringing their ideas, you bringing your ideas, and the playwright expressing their ideas, is that each one of us as artists comes at it from a particular perspective, but we're all working towards the same grain of a mustard seed. And like, what is that? And then how do we sort of make that grow? We actually didn't think, Damaso, about like, if we were to put it on the Imago stage, what that would be. Because I think we got so lost in the ideas of potentiality, the production. So.
Yeah. Well, and that was a gift to the process, I think. The invitation was, don't worry about the budget. Don't worry about
it was awesome.
Even in this theater's, you know, limitations or opportunities. Just what might the play be, right?
So I've directed a handful of readings. I love directing readings, but I've never directed like a 28-hour reading?
29.
Where you have like, I mean, there was more staging. I mean, music stands, but there was more staging. There was more physical interaction between the actors than like I've ever had enough time for it to make sense to try to incorporate. So. Just how do you decide, how do you work with the actors to figure out what kinds of things to show the audience versus what to just let be read, mm-hmm. And what you can dramatize or what you can embody without it getting in the way of the actor who still like needs to be connected to the text, etc.
So there's sort of, you know, over the years, because I've been doing this for quite a while now, and over the years, you learn a formula that you can work with that best gives you the end result that you need. And each play, in my experience, speaks to a different process. There are some plays that are much more physical in 29 hours than others. There's some writers who really need the time spent mostly around the table. And then their play is best served with, you know, sitting down at music stands. And so your job as a director is different. How are they different? It's really about the stage directions. How do you treat the stage directions? So in this case, because Reggie Hoops is such a physical production and a physical play, I met with our stage manager before, about an hour before rehearsal on the day that we got up on our feet and gave them the stage directions that I thought we would use. And then I have a script already laid out for my stage direction reader. So when they join the process, they then read those stage directions. And actors are smart enough where you just say, these are the stage directions we're going with. Let's see if this works. And then if it, you know, there's something that they're like, oh, I really need this stage direction. Can we please add that back? And then you get up on your feet and you say to the actors, there are four of you in this act, so you've got four music stands. I want you just to play and move in space. And their actors are smart enough to know where to move. You know, you say to them, if this music stand on the right is used in this scene, please choose the one on the left for the next scene. And then they play. And then if you're lucky enough to have a couple of hours before you go on, you know, in front of an audience, let them go through it themselves, take copious notes, and then remind them that they need to move in space and that they're allowed to move in space, and give them your notes and they're good to go. That's how I do it. That's my formula. I just shared with everyone.
I love it.
Love it. I need to take note. Similar, I think actually, I noted that because I got to see Leah's reading before ours, our team's reading, and I thought, oh, you know, we use similar language. I mean, one of the things that comes up very early in a stage reading is how much staging do you do, right? And then what do you do? A lot of times, you know, an actor's instinct is to pantomime, right? Pantomime the object, what I've learned over the years is it's too hard to keep track of and actually takes a lot more rehearsal time. So I will set some sort of, like, here's sort of the rules of the game of this, right? And I used to be an improviser for many years and was part of a, like, long-form improvisation. And the format in long-form improvisation is that there's a back line. That's the offstage position. And then when it's your turn to play the scene, you step forward toward the front and your scene partners join you. So I find this always very familiar, right? Recognizable. And so we sort of establish, like, when you're in these chairs upstage, that's offstage. And once we introduce your character with a stage direction, we don't have to introduce you again. So now you can just enter, unless it's very important for the audience to know that you're coming from the kitchen. And so we might purposely add that stage direction. So it's really about whatever the staging is to help the actor feel like have to act less and just sort of be present in the moment, and then for the audience to have enough information so they're not confused, right? And in the case of, so sometimes my rule is almost like read as few stage directions as possible and only stage just enough, frankly, to help the actor, you know, be in the moment. So I will tend to say, you know, in Chris Pena's play, there's an Emmy, right? It's a very important prop. So you have to describe the Emmy when it's pulled out, but instead of the actor needing to have their script and, like, pretend to hold the Emmy, I'll just say endow your binder with the Emmy, right? And just when you want to focus on the Emmy and gesture toward it, just gesture to the corner of your binder that you're holding. You know, there's a moment in the play where they carry a dog on stage. There's a moment in the play where they carry a baby on stage. And it's like, well, you have this script. You need it anyway because you're not off book and everyone knows you're not memorized. So you don't need to pretend to be doing anything more than that. So just kind of endow the script in that moment with the quality of the baby, just so that you don't have to act very much. And so those are sort of the rules going in. Something that came up in this, I think it's relevant to, like, our process in general and how they've evolved, but there were kisses in both of our plays. And the actors in our room were, like, very up for doing the kisses. And I said, well, we don't have an intimacy coach. And really, that's not what this staging is about. So the stage direction will just be read. And, you know, that's just an example of deciding what to stage is really, really important. Because I've seen readings where people are running around and practically playing out whole scenes. But in the end, to do that really well, it takes weeks of work. So let's not even pretend we can pull that off.
Yeah, the intimacy was something that came to mind with both shows, that there was a certain amount of touch that was established to provide relationship, some things that could be done pretty easily, right? Mm-hmm. And then for something like they kiss, or there's, like, an extended, you know, he kisses his face, his eyes, his head, you know, that the actors are just sort of holding eye contact, mm-hmm, in sort of a close proximity while that is read.
And I think the audience imagination is activated. I think that's a fun thing about a reading. I really loved in Reggie Hoops, the character pulls out a gun, but it's not like the actor is walking around holding a pantomime gun. The stage direction said he has a gun. And then we all believe it and listen.
And it was helpful that he kept his phone,
yeah,
in his pocket, in that particular pocket, so then he just touched it with, yeah, his hand.
Oh.
And that's all you need is touch.
Oh,
physicality,
yeah,
of touch. It's a Meyerhold is a brilliant director who specializes and focuses on physicalization of movement and how your body speaks in place of your words.
Huh.
That was a very, one of those moments.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Yeah, it's like, what is the least you need to let the audience's imagination fill in the rest? Sort of like,
yeah,
that thing where they're like, most of the letters are missing from a word, but you can still read it.
I love that.
Any big surprises or Oh, we'll just go with surprises. Like, any surprises from the week?
I think in our case, the big surprise was on Sunday, learning that our lead was sick and that we needed a new lead. And so that really sort of determined, because we'd had a conversation with our designer about how we, our set designer, about how we imagine, and sound designer, about how we imagine the workshop going. And then after that conversation, heard from the artistic director that our lead was gone and that you fabulously stepped in on that Monday and read for us, which was just extraordinary, so that we were able to continue to invest in the story without worrying or having concern. So we thank you for that and just want your public to know how brilliant you are as an actor. And then also how swiftly Profile worked to find us a fantastic actor who stepped in on the Tuesday. So I think that was one big surprise. And then for me, I think the other big surprise was how many new, you know, our Diaz came in saying, I really feel like my play is pretty much set. And then by Wednesday, completely restructured, rewrote, added, and then on Thursday we read almost a brand new script in essence. And then on Saturday after the reading, then said, wow, I see, I'm so excited to go back and do some more work. That's when you know you've had a successful week of a workshop. So it feels good. And that was a lovely surprise in the end.
Yeah. We're often on the same page, Leah. Chris Pena similarly said, you know, I think it basically, the architecture of the place here works. I think Diaz may have used the word architecture, but they both had that same impression. So we're now just going to investigate the details, right? That was the sort of the spirit we went into it. And then on when, and we discovered that first day with the creative teams at the table that Chris Pena had written a two-act play, but we all pretty quickly said, no, it's just, maybe it needs to be streamlined to an intermissionless one-act. But then the work in those first couple of days inspired the day off Wednesday, the day off for the actors, where Chris Pena really did, wrote many more pages, new scenes, and we put that in, we sort of went back to the table, and then did our reading and discovered the play was longer than it was, significantly longer than when it was at the beginning. And then in our discussion following that reading, where the whole group discusses the play, it was prose, maybe it's a two-act play, right? And maybe there's even more to it that we haven't even seen yet. And so I think that was just a surprise, pleasant surprise that you say that there is more, with great work, there's more that you can do. Right, and both these writers can go and produce another draft that will maybe surprise us again.
Yeah, and when you have great writers, man, you know, they're going to do the work. So yeah. It makes your job easy. Mm-hmm. Really does.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, thank you both. This has been really fun to be able to talk to you both about directing stuff. I like it.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Thanks for having us
a Profile.
So much appreciation to our guest directors, Leah C. Gardner and Damaso Rodriguez, for taking the time to share about their work in the room, helping to develop these new pieces. Reggie Hoops by Christopher Diaz and Our Orange Sky by Christopher Oscar Pena. And once more, I will say we are presenting these two plays as world premieres in our 23-24 season. However, you do not have to wait until next season to check out work by Christopher Oscar Pena. His play, How to Make an American Son, opens June 10th and runs through June 25th. And it is a wonderful piece, and I do hope you will join us and check it out. If you're interested in hearing more about the work that goes into making the work, subscribe to Satellite Beyond the Page podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or you can listen to them in our on-air tab on the website profiletheater.org. This episode was edited and produced by me, Tamara Carroll. Our line producer is Jamie M. Ray. Additional editing and sound engineering by Robert A.K. Gagno. We exist on the traditional lands of the Multnomah, Kathlamet, Clackamas, Tumwater, and Malala bands of the Chinook peoples, the Tualatin band of the Kalapuya peoples, and many other tribes who made their homes along the Willamette and Columbia rivers. We honor the ancestors of this place and acknowledge that we are here now because of the sacrifices forced upon them. We honor their descendants who live among us.